Love music. Live sport. Pole Position with Andy Alston on Rock Sport Radio.
Hello and welcome to Pole Position, the motorsport show here on Rock Sport. Andy Alston with you alongside Adam Todd. And Adam, I have a bit of a confession to make right here at the top of the show. And I was really worried earlier in the week, and I was going to give you a call, but I thought better of it. But anyway, I received a direct message on Twitter, and it was from the FIA, you know, the proper official account at FIA. And I thought, oh no, you know, they've downloaded the podcast last week and they've heard me criticising the Paul Ricard circuit on the show, and I'm going, oh no, this is going to be like a total disaster. But no, it was to say best wishes to you and your loved ones, wishing you a safe and successful 2018. That was really nice of
them. That was very kind of them, wasn't it? I hope you replied.
No, I didn't. Oh, but I tell you, it was absolutely terrifying. But so we're off the hook so far. Let's just see how we get on this week. But Adam, one story that's been making the news is that Daniel Kvyat has signed for Ferrari as a development driver. So what's your take on that one? That's a pretty interesting move.
Very interesting indeed, and completely out of the blue. I don't think any of us really expected to see Kvyat back in Formula 1. And I don't mean that in a bad way, just the way his career kind of panned out. I think he's a very talented driver, obviously not to the same level as your Alonso, Vettels, Hamilton, Verstappens, but I still think that he had something to offer to the sport. And we all know his history. He was obviously at Toro Rosso, got promoted to Red Bull, then demoted back down to the junior team. And obviously he's now landing on his feet with this role at Ferrari. Yes, he's not going to be racing in Formula 1, but a development driver for Ferrari is no mean feat either. So good. I was glad to see it happen.
And do you think, just, I mean, hindsight's always 2020, isn't it? But, you know, do you think he maybe moved to Red Bull a little bit too early back in 2015?
It's a difficult question. You know, every F1 driver will say they're ready for the top teams. It was the same with Pascal Wehrlein when the Mercedes seat became available. But I actually thought that he was ready, because at that time, Red Bull, they weren't exactly fighting for the world championship. I suppose they could take a risk on Kvyat, and he did all right in that Toro Rosso season, so I thought, you know, you may as well promote him, because Red Bull were short of options when Vettel obviously announced that he was going to Ferrari. So I'd probably say it was the right time for Kvyat, and you've got to take your opportunities in Formula 1 and grasp them with both arms.
I keep saying this, but was he the right driver to go into that Red Bull car? Because he had Jean-Éric Vergne alongside him at Toro Rosso at that point, and, you know, I rate him very highly, and I thought Vergne was very hard done by at that point.
Yeah, I agree as well, because Jean-Éric Vergne had actually outscored Daniel Ricciardo in 2012 and was ahead of him in 2013 when Ricciardo was promoted to Red Bull, so I absolutely agree with that. What's actually interesting, as you mentioned, Jean-Éric Vergne, he actually got a Ferrari role after he had left.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether Ferrari are after some inside information about Red Bull, who are one of the rivals. That could be interesting, because who knows how Red Bull operate at the end of the day. They are one of Ferrari's major rivals, so perhaps that's an interesting concept that perhaps he came up with. But no, I think Kvyat at that time, as I said, Red Bull were short of options, and you know, he was talked up as about being a potential future world champion at that time. I remember when he came into the sport, he was not, say, people weren't talking about the same level that they were Max Verstappen when he came into the sport, but they weren't far off. They're really rating this young Russian kid, and unfortunately it didn't pan out that way.
Yeah, and when Verstappen arrived on the scene, you know, it was very clear that he was going to be moved to the senior Red Bull team sooner rather than later. But were you surprised by the way in which that switch was made?
Well, I thought that Kvyat did very well, because he actually beat Daniel Ricciardo, and people don't seem to remember that. Yes, it was a bad year for Red Bull, and when I actually look at the retirements, Ricciardo had more retirements that year, so it wasn't as if Ricciardo had been unlucky that year. So in a head-to-head fight over the entire season, Kvyat actually beat Ricciardo, and look how highly rated Ricciardo is. You know, the rumours Mercedes and Ferrari are interested in, the two best teams in Formula 1 at the moment. So for me, I think Kvyat did very well, but you know, Red Bull, as you said, Verstappen was coming into the team. They had to find a gap somewhere, otherwise risk losing Max Verstappen, who undoubtedly is going to be a star of the future. He already is a star, and he's going to be a multiple world champion. I've no doubt about that. So Red Bull had to act quickly, and that's just the cutthroat business of Formula 1. Was it harsh? Yes, it was. But at the end of the day, Red Bull have to look from a perspective. How are they going to keep hold of the future of Max Verstappen, and how are they going to win races and championships, which is why they're in the sport?
And Adam, I might be in the minority here, but I actually think this is a really good bit of business by Ferrari. Now, everyone initially reacts and says, oh, Kvyat, he's not going to be driver's champion, he's not a front runner. Put all that to one side, and you touched on it there a moment ago, because they're going to get some absolutely fantastic data through this young driver. You know, he's raced with the same Renault engine that Red Bull have used, so there's a lot of information there about how that works. And he's also got knowledge about how Red Bull and Toro Rosso, of course, how they operate behind the scenes, and that's very, very beneficial to a team like Ferrari.
Certainly will be for Ferrari, who have been fighting Red Bull for the past few seasons, and you cannot beat a development driver that's been in Formula 1. A lot of the development test drivers now are kind of young rookies. You look at Ferrari last season, it was Antonio Giovinazzi and Charles Leclerc who were kind of doing that role, and I know Giovinazzi is staying in that role, but it's better to have someone who's been there, who's done it, who's got the experience, who has the inside knowledge of other teams, and can maybe bring what Red Bull done well into Ferrari. So I absolutely agree with you. It is a good piece of business. And he got a bad name, let's be honest, Kvyat, because on his day, he could race. And obviously, there was a few incidents with the crashes, especially in Russia a few years ago. But no, I thought Kvyat did. It was ultimately hard done by. So it's good to see Ferrari do this piece of business, and it could be very beneficial in the future.
Now, I wonder if Kvyat taking a year out of the firing line will do him some good in the longer term, because, you know, it might create a path back into a race drive. Maybe someone like Sauber, I'm thinking here, you know, Ferrari partnership with them. So I would say maybe never say never with him, but I think just take a breather and just, you know, just let things happen and move on from there.
Absolutely. I was shocked when I heard that they wouldn't be retaining Kvyat. I could understand it, Toro Rosso not retaining him, because he'd had his chance at Red Bull, and is he really going to get back up to Red Bull? But he came back into the US Grand Prix because, to put you in the picture, he was demoted earlier on in the season. He was then brought in again at Toro Rosso, scored a point in the US, and at that time Toro Rosso hadn't scored points for a while. And I think they scored their only point with Kvyat in the final six races or whatever it was. And then he was dropped again and he wouldn't be retained. So I thought that was very harsh. And I think you're spot on. A year out will do him the world of good, because mentally, you know, it doesn't matter what sport you play, but the top quality drivers in this case, you know, in terms of racecraft, not a lot will separate them. What's key is your mentality, getting up when you're down. And Kvyat's mentality, I cannot imagine what that boy's had to go through with the amount of demotions he's had, and especially in Formula 1, because it's a cooker pressure environment. Everybody's on your case, everybody's wanting interviews with you, and he's given the same answers, people asking why have you been demoted. So I think a year out will be extremely beneficial for him, and hopefully get him in a better mental state to, who knows, potentially get another Formula 1 drive next year.
Adam, we've avoided this next topic on the show for a while now, and we can't keep doing it for much longer. I've got to ask you about this now, because the news this week is that the new Halo device, which will be implemented this season, could feature some kind of digital information ticker on it. I mean, Adam, is this a step too far?
Yes, I mean, I didn't even read too much of the article, because I just think it's a wee bit farcical, you know. I mean, let the Halo sink in for a wee bit, because in my opinion, it's a wee bit of a short-term fix, the Halo, in the sense that they've kind of rushed the decision. Yes, they've been discussing about how to get better head protection in the cockpit for the Formula One drivers for years now. But just let them get the Halo right without having to bother with all this digital stuff. You know, the Halo's not there to be pretty at the moment. And yeah, we'll see what happens. But for me, it's a bit farcical.
I mean, what kind of information could you get on that Halo? You know, I'm just thinking about the size of it here. I mean, you know, the car number potentially, that's already on, you know, towards the nose cone. I mean, it's at the back as well. I mean, what is the point?
Yeah,
I'm struggling, Adam.
Yeah, I'm speechless as well, Andy, because I was thinking, what are they going to put the race timing on? It's a ludicrous situation. And as I said, they would have been better to have a full season just with the Halo and then adapt. But they're trying to do too many things at once, and that's when mistakes happen, and ultimately it'll just look bad in the sport.
I have to be honest here and say that I'm a little bit concerned about this Halo device from a safety point of view. Now, I'm not one of these people that says open wheel racing should be protected at all costs. That's, you know, that's totally not where I'm coming from here. But anything at all that limits the visibility of the driver is surely a problem.
Yep, I agree to a certain extent. I know the FIA have done tests, and they had the initial Halo, which I think was driven by Nico Hülkenberg. And at that point, he did complain about visibility. However, you know, especially going uphill, there was a real concern about what the halo would do for drivers. But I know Nico Rosberg had it at the Belgian Grand Prix maybe a year and a half ago now, and he was going up a Rouge, which is one of the steepest hills in the sport, and he was able to see fine. So I think they've kind of ironed out the visibility issues with regards to the halo.
Well, I'm not too sure, Adam, because, you know, drivers can test with, you know, the device in a fairly, you know, calm environment, free practice or whatever. But for me, there's a clear difference between testing in relatively clear traffic and racing with it. Now, my concern is that when the lights go out in Melbourne and everyone's trying to squeeze through that very tough first corner come chicane, having a restriction on visibility is not going to make that any easier.
Yeah, you're spot on. I mean, it's all very well doing these tests on a Friday morning when it's quiet, not too many teams out there. And perhaps a better idea from the FIA would have been to have trialled this in junior categories when there is proper racing, because, as you say, they're going to get Talbot Park and it's going to be the first time with these halo devices. All 20 cars have them. They're all racing, all heading down to turn one. We're not too sure how it's all going to pan out. Whereas if they'd done them in the junior categories, then they'd be able to learn from what the drivers in the lower categories are telling them and then make sure that they've got the right cockpit protection for the drivers, because that's ultimately what it's all about here.
Now, this again, it might seem like a bit of an obvious question, Adam, but, you know, let's say you're on the back row of the grid in the first race of the season. Are drivers going to be able to see the lights going out? You know, because think of the height of the halo, you know, in terms of the driver's, you know, line of sight. These are fundamental questions. Now, presumably the FIA have run various simulations and used all sorts of sophisticated software which will tell us otherwise, but the fact that we're having this kind of fundamental, you know, very basic questions surely raises a number of concerns when the season's going to start in a few months' time.
Yeah, you're spot on. As you said, you would have liked to have thought the FIA have done all these checks. However, I do have my question marks in the sense that it has been rushed through. If you remember, they wanted the halo on for last season's car in 2017, but that didn't go through because they were still doing tests, they were still trying to get it right. We're now heading into 2018 and we're still having a lot of the same questions happening again. So it's kind of been forced upon. They've been desperate to get it in, and I suppose from a safety perspective, rightly so. The sooner you can get something that's going to enhance driver safety, the better. But at the same time, you need to make sure there's no fundamental flaws with it and it will 100% do what you want it to do. And I mean, as you said, if it does reduce visibility, then it's actually making it unsafer for the drivers. So it'll be interesting to see what does happen in Australia, and I'm sure a lot of the drivers will all be giving feedback on how it has worked.
Now, Adam, I've been reading a lot of comments from fans on social media saying that this is the end of attractive looking Formula One cars and things like that, and, you know, I don't really take that view, because safety is far more important than the look of the car. But I just wonder if the halo is the right solution to this problem.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a few other concepts. Red Bull had this kind of shield design, a bit like a fighter jet cockpit. And we also had Ferrari kind of trial something like that. Again, there was issues raised about visibility. If it rains, will drivers actually be able to see out the screen, you know? So there was kind of issues like that. But at the end of the day, the FIA did have to act, because there has been a number of tragic events. Obviously, Henry Surtees, the son of former world champion John Surtees, you know, he was killed in a Formula 2 race. You've had Felipe Massa just a few weeks later at the Hungarian Grand Prix when he was hit with a loose spring. So they'd be foolish not to have learned from those mistakes, and it's good to see that the FIA have finally came up with something. Whether it's the right thing, I'm still unconvinced. And they have been doing research for this. A lot of people think that it has just been in the last kind of 12, 18 months, but they have been doing lots of research for a while now on kind of cockpit protection. So let's see how the halo gets on.
Now, moving on to Williams, and there are strong rumours that Robert Kubica won't be making a return to Formula 1 this year, with Sergei Sirotkin set to take that second seat alongside Lance Stroll. Now, joining us to discuss this is Stuart Codling, Executive Editor of F1 Racing and Autosport. And Stuart, what's your reaction to this?
Well, it's a little bit disappointing, because Robert Kubica would have been a much more interesting story. Sergei Sirotkin by rule of thumb, looking at the viewing figures, as it were, on our sister website, autosport.com, just doesn't really register or resonate with our readers at all. No one's really interested in him, except perhaps in Mother Russia.
Interesting. And do you think
that money has played a factor in this decision, or is it purely on pace, as Williams are suggesting?
Well, I mean, from what we've heard, there was a disparity in the amount of money available, in that Kubica, we heard, has come up with €8 million, whereas Sorokin is likely to bring €15 million, and he's got a trail of connections that go all the way up to Vladimir Putin. But to be fair to Williams, they had actually built all their strategy for the drivers this year around Kubica, which is why it's been taking so long to reach a decision or for us to hear about what's going on, because all the contracts have been drawn up for Kubica, and what actually happened was that the final test after the last Grand Prix of the season was when the deal started to fall apart, and they assessed Robert's performance. And once they'd evened out all the variables, because of course it's very difficult to compare drivers between different tyre compounds, different days, different ambient weather conditions, they apparently, from what we hear, worked out that basically Robert was only about 0.3 of a second faster than Lance Stroll on average, and Felipe Massa had been 0.7 of a second faster than Stroll on average throughout the season. So they kind of realised it wasn't really working for them. And perhaps Sorokin would be a better long-term deal. So that deal sort of fell out of bed. And they're currently working out details with Sorokin. We hear probably the contract will be signed this week, maybe next week, and we'll get an announcement very soon.
Stuart, do you think Williams have missed a trick, though, in terms of a marketing potential around Kubica? Because I could see a lot of businesses wanting to get on board with that.
Well, colossally. I mean, it's basically an awful screw-up, because they've got basically probably their most uninspiring driver lineup since, I'd say, 2012, when they had Pastor Maldonado and Bruno Senna. It's not very interesting for marketing purposes, and certainly Kubica would have been brilliant PR, which was why they were kind of prepared to hang their coat on him from September onwards. They weren't really entertaining any of the people for that seat apart from Kubica, and that was probably their mistake. They didn't have any other irons in the fire, as it were. And when Felipe Massa decided that he was going to walk away from Formula One again, they didn't really have many more options. And certainly for the past few years, they have had a slightly uninspiring driver lineup PR-wise. And for a team that flies the British flag, you would kind of want someone who had a bit more traction.
Now, obviously, there's a lot of emotion around this potential Kubica return, and you know, I'm sure everyone would love to see him back in Formula One, but of course, he tested with Renault earlier in the season, and they didn't take that further either.
Yeah, from what we hear, the reason Renault didn't take him further forward, exactly the same reasons as eventually Williams passed on him as well. They felt, certainly in Renault's case, they decided that they would go for Carlos Sainz as a better long-term bet than Robert, because you know, Robert's now in his 30s. He's kind of coming towards, even if he hadn't had his injury, he'd be coming towards the end of his career. And I think the real pity is that he's kind of so close to being there. When you think that we're talking about 0.3 of a second faster than the sitting driver in the other seat, ordinarily that wouldn't be too bad, but it just so happens that the guy in the other seat is a rich rookie who has to stay there.
Stuart, I've just read some rumours about Kubica maybe struggling to adapt to the new tyres. Have you got any information on that?
Well, there is a school of thought that perhaps it'd have taken a bit more time to get used to them, and some people think that possibly the extra physicality of the extra grip and the greater downforce with the current cars would have been a bit of a problem, given that he has a weaker arm and the cockpit would have had to have been adjusted for him. But Renault did that. And certainly it seems that we don't actually have access to the data, but it does seem that it was when he went into the 2017 car that was when both Renault and Williams went a bit cold on him.
So do you think that we'll see Kubica racing in some form this year?
Hopefully. He backed away from racing in the World Endurance Championship this time last year, I think probably because he had a sniff of the Formula One drive coming up. The problem he has is that he had a big insurance payout when he had his injury that was based on him never actually working again as a professional racing driver. Now, he invested that widely in property, so should the insurers come calling again, if he does get a job driving again, he will be able to refund them and settle with that. I suppose the thing for him is that he always loved rallying, which is why he went off rallying and had that accident in the first place. I'm not sure World Endurance Racing really cut it for him. And when he went rallying under his own steam as a privateer with his own team, that didn't go so brilliantly either. So this actually could be him off the radar, which is a bit of a tragedy, because he's a proper no-nonsense racer. He's a very nice bloke, and it would have been a great story to see him come back a few years after a life-threatening injury.
Is there an element of, should he move to another category and do well, people will say, ah, well, he's not in Formula 1. And then if he struggles, people will say, ah, well, that's why he's not in Formula 1. You know, it's a bit of a catch-22 situation in some respects.
Yeah, it's tricky. And I would say that the main challenge he would have faced in the World Endurance Championship is that if he was driving a prototype car, he would have had to have shared with two other drivers. So if you had a cockpit and control system adapted to him and his weaker arm, that would involve the two other drivers having to adapt themselves to that rather than anything else happening. So most drivers in sports cars, the most adaptation that occurs between stints when they swap over is the shortest driver gets a little booster cushion so that they can actually reach the cushions. So that kind of puts him a little bit out of the running for a shared category like sports car racing. I can't see him bothering with any of the kind of one step down from the kind of Formula 2, GT3, because their Formula towards Formula 1 rather than being a parachute outfit.
Stuart,
kind of rallying might be his only option.
We've been discussing Paul de Rest on this show quite a lot, and you know, we're both wondering why he wasn't a serious candidate for this Williams drive, because you know, he did very well when he jumped into that car at the last minute in Hungary.
It is quite peculiar, and the simple answer is I really don't know, because as you say, he did well in the car. He's not a bad driver. I think sometimes it can be a little bit prickly to deal with, and that has probably counted against him in previous years. But as a driver, I would certainly have him in preference to Sergei Sirotkin. If I were Claire Williams and I had a choice between Sergei Sirotkin and Paul de Resta, I would go with Paul de Resta.
So, looking at Sirotkin, what is it he brings to Williams?
Apart from €50 million, I would say he is an established Formula 2 race winner, albeit in favourable circumstances. So he's not awful. He's not someone who's buying his way into the drive that he might otherwise not have got. He just might not necessarily have been their first choice had someone better been available. So they're kind of making do with him. As I said to you earlier, the trouble is that he's not very interesting. Without wishing to sound at all offensive, you know, he doesn't look like a racing driver. He's not very marketable. He's sort of he looks a bit spotty. So if you're a clothes manufacturer or a perfume manufacturer or even, I don't know, a drinks manufacturer, you wouldn't necessarily want him in your marketing materials, because he's not really much of a poster boy. Whereas, you know, Lance Stroll does have the eyebrows of a Dolmio man, but he kind of looks more photogenic. So marketing-wise, I'm not sure Sergei really cuts it. So he might prove it all wrong, but I'm not sure he's going to be the most memorable addition to Formula 1 in 2018.
And just finally, Stuart, what are your expectations for Williams this season?
I think they're in trouble, because they've been pursuing a technical concept that's had diminishing returns for them over the previous three or four seasons. So they need a new car concept. With Paddy Lowe at the technical helm, maybe that will happen. He's probably spent the past season just thinking of something completely different. So hopefully the car will be better. And it really does need to be, because Force India have had their best year ever. They nailed down fourth place, best of the rest in the Constructors' Championship, well in advance of the end of the season. So by Mexico, they'd got their coat down on that one. So they were able to start experimenting with their 2018 concepts in the last few races. So they've already got a head start for 2018. Williams really need to nail down fourth place in the Constructors' Championship again, because otherwise that will hurt them in their wallet, and they'll be kind of locked into this cycle of always having to pick drivers who bring a budget.
Stuart, that's excellent. Thanks very much for joining us on RockSport. It's been great to have you with us. Thanks for taking the time to speak to us.
Thank you.
Stuart Codling there, Executive Editor of F1 Racing and Autosport, joining us on Pole Position. And Adam, when I was browsing the Autosport website earlier this week, I was interested to read that McLaren have predicted that they will undergo the biggest change of all the teams on the grid this season. Now, they raced in their orange and black livery last year, and they seem to be suggesting that they're going for a complete rebrand this season. You know, what do you make of that?
Yeah, well, I think McLaren, you know, I don't want to use the word toxic, but they've almost became like that in the sense that from a marketing perspective, because of how badly they've been doing with McLaren Honda. I mean, they've had no title sponsor for a number of years now, and I've been surprised that they've actually been able to attract any sponsors just because of their sheer performances on the track. And I think luckily, because of how big the McLaren brand is, then that's been a huge benefit to them because of the history. If they didn't have that history, then McLaren would be in a real issues this season. And it was interesting to hear Zak Brown's comments about him saying that they'll be the biggest change. I've also heard rumours that the car's going to be yellow, which I don't believe, but you never know. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens with McLaren this year. I think it's the right time if they are going to kind of have that rebrand, new engine manufacturer, fresh start. You know, Zak Brown finally getting in, if you like. You know, he's had, I think, a few seasons now at McLaren, but this... a complete refresh. Obviously, it was Ron Dennis who'd done the deal with Honda. This is McLaren version two, if you like.
Yeah, I mean, Adam, I was just about to ask you that, because do you think that this is it? McLaren are just saying, well, we want a clean slate. You know, Ron Dennis has been, you know, such a key figure at McLaren for, what, nearly 40 years? You know, this isn't as if it's going to be an easy transition, but, you know, I just wonder, what do McLaren have to do in 2018 to ensure that, you know, they are back where a lot of people say should be, you know, fighting towards the front of the pack?
Well, firstly, it's big shoes to fill for everybody at McLaren, because obviously Ron Dennis done tremendous work for the team, you know, very successful as well for much of his time that he was there. I think the key in terms of how McLaren are going to be back at the front fighting for race victories is all dependent on that Renault engine, because McLaren... the glimmer of hope, if you like, that they've had over the past three seasons is that their chassis has been one of the best, or they claim it's one of the best on the grid, if not the best. And in 2018, this year, it's going to be the big test, because they've got Red Bull, who, in terms of design and chassis, aerodynamics, Adrian Newey, the king in that discipline. It's going to be interesting to see how they get on, because Red Bull are going to be the benchmark, and they're not going to have the excuses of the Honda engine this time around McLaren. And I think everybody in Formula 1 wants to see McLaren up there fighting, so I really hope it goes well for them. They've got a good driver lineup with Fernando Alonso and Stoffel Vandoorne. So for Alonso, obviously, he's not got long left in Formula 1 in terms of if he wants to win that third world championship, and he'll be hoping that McLaren can be competitive again. Stoffel, it's been a shame he's came into McLaren at the wrong time. You know, 10 years ago, he'd be fighting for world championships like Lewis Hamilton was when he joined McLaren as a rookie. So it'll be interesting to see what happens next season, but it's one of the most exciting things I'm looking forward to.
Now, Zak Brown seems to have a lot of ideas to change things at the team, but one of the interesting quotes from him was that he thinks that McLaren haven't been a leader in recent years, and I think there's a lot of truth behind that.
Yeah, I mean, I think because of their poor performances on the track, you know, they've not really been wanting to take too many risks off the track and kind of do anything new in terms of new technology or kind of be leaders on the track. There's been nothing that you've really thought, oh, hang on a minute, that's new, that's an interesting concept. It's as if they've been stuck with this Honda engine, and they're too almost scared in a sense that they can't afford to go backwards, they can't afford to take risks, they just need to get up that field as quick as possible. So I think there is a lot of truth to that. And as we talked about, now that Ron Dennis isn't there with Zak Brown, this is going to be a completely new, fresh start. They're not going to have those excuses, and this is a huge year coming up for McLaren.
Adam, could you just give us a bit of context behind
how damaging the past three seasons have been for McLaren, because this is a team that is one of the, you know, the top outfits in Formula One. You know, one of the heritage that behind this team is incredible, and to see them struggling in the manner in which they have been, you know, not getting out of Q1 and things like that. You know, it was incredible to see a team like McLaren so far off the pace as they were in the last few years.
Absolutely. And in terms of context, if you think about Formula One, McLaren have been in for so long in the sport, they will look back in these 3 years and it won't be too long of time in the grand scheme of how long Formula One's been running for. But for 3 years, it has been hugely, hugely damaging to the McLaren brand as a whole as well. You know, it's just been miserable with Honda, and everybody was excited about this new McLaren-Honda partnership because of how well they'd done in the past, winning world championships. And people were probably expecting the same because of how well they'd done when they were last in the sport. So together, the partnership has just been a complete disaster. And unfortunately, people think of McLaren-Honda in this day and age, they're not going to remember the glory days.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to remember. And I think that's damaging for Honda as well as an engine manufacturer in Formula One. We've talked about sponsors, and in terms of a financial situation, I can't imagine they'll be in too good of a situation in terms of, you know, they've been not been finishing high up in the championship, even more prize money given away to the likes of Ferrari, Mercedes. And I really believe that it's the brand that's kept them ticking over, because if they didn't have that strong brand, as you talk about, the history, the heritage, then there would be in real issues. It's also been damaging to drivers in terms of Fernando Alonso. You know, he's meant to be one of the best drivers on the grid. He is one of the best drivers on the grid, but he's not had the machinery to be able to showcase his talent, which has been frustrating for every F1 fan.
And just when you mentioned Alonso there, it was very interesting to read Mark Webber's comments earlier this week when he said that Fernando is damaging his chances of a third driver's championship by taking part in Le Mans 24 Hours later this year. Was Webber being a little bit out of line there?
It's difficult to say because obviously Alonso and Webber are good buddies.
Maybe not now.
That's true. But Webber's got a point if Alonso's in a competitive car, because it is a distraction. Let's be frank about it, as a distraction. You know, he's not devoting 100% of his time to Formula One. The issue is you want to keep your driver happy, because if you have a driver that's happy to drive for the team, that'll benefit the team on track, because he'll be motivated. You don't want a demotivated driver. And if you go back to last season with Indy 500, it was a kind of new lease of life for Fernando after being stuck down with McLaren Honda for 2 years, not being able to showcase his talent. He was on this amazing American adventure that got the whole world of motorsport and beyond. You know, everybody was so excited about this. So I think to do Le Mans this year is going to be a harder challenge for Alonso, I believe. Will it be a distraction? The answer is, if he's fighting for a world championship, of course. If he's not, and he's fighting for just the odd podium, then I think your priority, if you're McLaren, is you want to hang on to Fernando, then keep him happy.
Of course, Alonso will be racing in the 24 Hours of Daytona in a fortnight as a little bit of a warm-up ahead of Le Mans. And he finished 12th fastest in a recent practice session, 1.7 seconds behind former Sauber driver Felipe Nasr. Now, Adam, what kind of challenges will Alonso be facing driving one of these endurance cars in comparison to his normal McLaren?
Well, there's a number of differences. Obviously, it's closed cockpit endurance racing as well, which will be completely new. Other challenges include traffic management, especially at night. And, you know, because especially at Le Mans, the amount of cars that are on the track in Le Mans, and they're a lot slower than the cars that he'll be driving if he does drive a Toyota LMP1 class. So it'll be interesting to see how he gets on there. It's also a heavier car, and it is a different type of driving style that will be required. But arguably, the biggest challenge for Alonso will be working in a team in terms of drivers. Obviously in Formula One it's a team sport, and he's working with group engineers and the whole team, but he's going to be working with two other drivers. And it was interesting to hear his comments, because he was actually talking about that was the most difficult bit, you know, getting in and out of the car during pit stops. Obviously he's with Lando Norris, his teammate, and Phil Hansen, who are both 18, I believe, and they're not as tall as Fernando Alonso, and they're talking about how the seatbelt was a bit of an issue. So I think that's going to be an issue. So there's lots of different challenges that are all new. So it's going to be a big learning curve for Fernando Alonso.
But the thing is as well, Adam, he's not a couple of tenths behind the front runners. He's 1.7 seconds behind. So, I mean, what does that come down to? Is that just lack of experience, perhaps, driving one of these endurance cars? Or is it the car that he's in that's perhaps the problem?
Well, you look at the timing sheets, and you touched on it. Felipe Nasr was top, and I think Alonso was 1.7 seconds. Yep. Now, we remember Felipe Nasr from Formula 1, from Sauber. And, you know, if you're comparing Felipe Nasr and Fernando Alonso, then we're led to believe that Fernando Alonso is the better driver, aren't we? So, from what I've read, it is the car. And I don't believe that Alonso expected to be challenging. So I think a lot of it is down to the car. But of course, it does take a while to adapt. With IndyCar, I was so impressed with Fernando Alonso because he took to IndyCar like a duck in water. It was sensational. But with these type of cars, I feel it's going to be a lot harder for Fernando Alonso, and perhaps is taking him a little bit longer to adapt. Mind you, you know, that's been 8 sessions now in the kind of pre Daytona 24 hours he has had, so you'd like to expect by now that's him getting on top of his game. And I think there was a session where Lando Norris actually finished ahead of him in the timing screens, but I know Alonso got the fastest lap in the final session. So 1.7 seconds off. For me, it's more the car that's the issue rather than Fernando Alonso. Mm.
Now, Adam, some people have criticised Alonso's decision, you know, in addition to Mark Webber, to take part in Le Mans because, you know, they're saying it's during the season and what have you. But, you know, Nico Hülkenberg did it and won back in 2015 with Porsche. So, I mean, what's the big deal? Is this just because he's Fernando Alonso?
Well, I've talked about the issues that Fernando Alonso is going to face, and you almost do forget now that Nico Hülkenberg has won Le Mans and he was racing Formula 1. It was interesting, Mark Webber's quote actually did say, though, that Nico Hülkenberg was driving with almost a kind of second tier team, in the sense he wasn't going to be fighting for world championships. And it comes back to my earlier point with Fernando Alonso. If he is going to be fighting for regular race victories, if he's going to be fighting for a world championship, then that is the issue. You know, Fernando Alonso is seen as a Formula 1 driver and nothing else. So I think you're right to say that, is it because of Fernando Alonso and who he is? So ultimately, it's going to come down to that question. If McLaren provide him with a competitive car and he's racing, of course it's a distraction. If not, then you want to keep him happy, because I'm sure it's in McLaren's best interest to retain one of the best drivers on the grid.
Yeah, it is. It's, I mean, Alonso's made no secret of the fact that he wants this triple crown in motorsport. So, I mean, we can't begrudge him going and doing this year. So, I mean, I just feel that people are just taking this as a little opportunity to have a dig at Alonso. And I just don't think, you know, he's been treated fairly here.
And he has also made clear that his priority still is Formula 1.
Yeah.
You know, we know how desperate he is to win the third World Championship. So I think if he does get a competitive car and he is really fighting for the World Championship, who knows? He might give Le Mans a miss, perhaps. Because I think the Triple Crown can still be achieved later, but I think Formula 1 is still his full focus at the moment. So I'm sure that if Fernando Alonso does get to the stage where he is winning races, he is fighting for the World Championship, then, you know, he could not race in Le Mans. You know, it wouldn't be out of the question. And I'm sure the bosses at McLaren, you know, who knows, there could be a clause in the contract, perhaps. We just don't know what will happen.
Hmm. Now, Adam, moving on to the world of rally, and former Spurs and Chelsea manager, I'm still in motorsport here, you know, I know I'm mentioning football, but Andre Villas-Boas, you know, he's withdrawn from the Dakar rally after damaging his back during the fourth stage of the event. So joining us to talk more about this and the world of rally is our expert David Halley. And David, what's your take on having Villas-Boas in this event in the first place? You know, it seems almost like a little bit of a gimmick to me.
It can be a gimmick. The Dakar event has attracted attention from all parts of the world, and everybody, a lot of people know about it and want to have a go. I don't think the event has seen so much coverage since Mark Thatcher got lost in the desert back in the early 80s, and it has brought the event certainly to your attention a lot more closely, and to a lot of people around the world. It has brought the event to their attention where they probably weren't aware of it before.
David, just tell us a little bit more about the Dakar rally. You know, we've got around, 500 drivers involved in this. It's more than just, you know, everyone focuses on the front runners, but this is a massive occasion for motorsport.
It is part of a series, but it is a very much a one-off. Now, it started in the late 70s as an event run from Paris to Dakar, which is the capital of Senegal on the west coast of Africa. And it was an adventure back then, and it still is an adventure to this day. In 2008, the event was cancelled at very last minute following threats from terrorists in Mauritania that they were going to attack people on the rally. The 2008 event was cancelled. 2009, the event moved to South America. And the countries of South America are very keen to have it there. It brings a lot of attention to them and to their countries. And this year it's running through Peru, Bolivia and into Argentina.
And Sebastian Loeb is out of what will probably be his last ever Dakar rally as well. You know, that must be a massive disappointment for him.
Oh, huge disappointment for him. He's been very successful in everything he's done up to the point he took on the Dakar. And the Dakar, if you imagine, the World Rally Championship has 12 rounds and each round has about 300 competitive kilometres in it over a weekend. This is a two-week event with 4,500 kilometres of competitive mileage in it. So it is doing the World Rally Championship in 2 weeks.
And Carlos Sainz has come out and said that the first stages in Peru were too difficult for amateur drivers. Is that something you would agree with?
It is very difficult, yes. They've met with some very, very strange sand conditions where sand holes have been appearing literally as the cars approach them. So this is what has put Loeb out. He fell into a sand hole and damaged his co-driver's back very badly. Same with your football manager, Chaffee. He landed in a sand hole very hard. The seats of these of competition cars are not very compliant. They're designed to hold you very firmly in place, but if you do land hard, then that shock will transfer through the body.
Now, the drivers are set to race in Bolivia, so what can they expect there?
Bolivia is slightly less deserty than Peru, so they're going to be up in the mountains. So this is they're going to be 2,000-3,000 feet above meters above sea level. So they'll have difficulty breathing. The cars will have difficulty breathing, and it'll be incredibly cold, even though it's in theory the height of their summer.
And this is the 40th year of the event, and the 10th year in a row that it's taken place in South America. So what is it about the Dakar Rally that is just so special?
It's the draw of it. It is the challenge. It's an enormous challenge. It's probably the last big challenge in motorsport that's available. And it does attract over 500 competitors. So there's 335 vehicles started the event. We're only into day six, and we've lost already nearly 60 of those competitive vehicles have gone through either accident or injury. So it is a massive challenge, and there is no route through the desert, really. They're following this. There's no pace notes like you have in a World Rally Championship event. They're following very basic route instructions to get themselves through the desert.
And there's lots of different vehicles, of course, taking part in this event as well.
It's four events in one. There's bikes, quads, cars, and then within the car section there's also what they call the side-by-sides. It's a big quad with two people. If you know the Polaris brand of sort of farm vehicle or off-road vehicle. And then the trucks as well. The trucks, although they are support trucks in a lot of cases, they are also driving competitively.
And just finally, David, what should we be looking out for over the next few days in the event?
Just the event, the leaders will change probably pretty regularly, even though some of them have got what looks like a very large lead. You can lose a very large lead very quickly. You fall into a sand hole, you can be there for an hour or two, and that can make the difference. So while Stefan Peter Hansel is still leading at the moment, Carlos Sainz is in second in the cars, Nasser Al-Attiyah and Mikko Hirvonen, both regular competitors in the past in the World Rally Championship, they are poised to have a bite at them if these two in the front run into any trouble at all.
Excellent. David, thank you very much for talking to us on Pole Position. It's great to have you on the show with us here.
No problem at all. Anytime you want, give us a call.
Rally expert David Halley there joining us on Rock Sport. And Adam, let's take a little look at Formula E, because there's lots going on there at the moment. And the first thing I want to get your thoughts on is Felipe Massa, because he's already been linked with a move to the series. And do you think that's a good new home for him in motorsport?
Yeah, I think it'd be more beneficial probably for Formula E, because a lot of people have been kind of criticising the driver lineup. It's kind of F1 rejects, in the sense they've not made it big in Formula 1, and to have somebody of Felipe Massa's calibre would be hugely beneficial to the series and bring a lot more people to the sport, and especially the Brazilians who just love motorsport. Obviously we've got two fantastic Brazilians in the sport who are world champions in Formula E in terms of Lucas de Grassi and also Nelson Piquet Jr. already, but I think Felipe Massa just brings, you know, that kind of aura about him, because he's been in Formula 1 and that'd be huge for him, and he's been winning races as well. So I think it'd be very beneficial for Formula E, and I think for Felipe Massa, you know, we know he wants to continue racing. I think this could be the perfect series for him.
Now, Massa's already tested for Jaguar, but I think the main thing for him is that he joins the sport and he's competitive straight away. You know, he was going to be 37 at the end of April. And I know there's older drivers in Formula E, but you know, he's not going to have too much time left in his career to really go and win a championship.
Absolutely. So he has to make sure that that car that he does get in, if he does join Formula E, is a competitive time, because as you rightly said, he is 37 years old now, and you've touched that there are other drivers that are older. You know, you've not got time to mess about when you're at that age. We've talked about Fernando Alonso a lot this evening. He's had 3 years of misery in Formula One, and people are saying, oh, he's coming to the end of his career. It's been three wasted years. And for Felipe Massa, he doesn't want to go through that in Formula E. So I think he's been very smart, from my understanding, he has had offers, but he wants to make sure that it is a competitive seat. And I think he's right waiting until next season, because potentially he could then get more tests and get better to it. Because, you know, when he did get that test with Jaguar through Williams Advanced Engineering, you know, he was saying that it's different power, brakes, tyres, downforce, so it's quite a different driving style. So again, getting more tests under his belt will be beneficial, and I certainly think a lot of teams will be looking at him.
Of course, another man that's going to be testing a Jaguar very soon is Paul de Resta, when he gets behind the wheel of one of the cars after the Moroccan E-Prix on Sunday. And he seems to be another driver that's very keen on a move to Formula E as well, doesn't he?
Yeah, I think what's interesting about Paul de Resta is, obviously, we talked about with Stuart from Autosport magazine about how well we've done in Hungary. Mm. And it seems as if that's kind of reignited his love of open wheel racing, because he's obviously been in DTM, closed cockpits, but single seaters that I feel that he really wants to be in. And as Stuart rightly said, you know, it's really disappointing that Paul de Resta won't be racing in Williams if Sergei Sirotkin is going to be the driver, is going to partner Lance Stroll next year. So it'll be interesting to see how these drivers do get on in the young test, because there's big names in this rookie test. You know, you've touched on Paul de Resta and Jaguar, you've also got Antonio Giovinazzi, yeah, who was very impressed with in Formula 1, and then you've got Gary Paffett from DTM, Nick DeVries, another young talent as well. So there's lots of interesting names that are all wanting a shot at Formula E. So again, that's good for the series to be attracting these names from all different disciplines of motorsport.
And you mentioned very, very one interesting name there among that list, Gary Paffett, because he's a driver that was in DTM for much of his career. De Resta has been in DTM for the last few years as well. Is there an element of drivers going to DTM? And you know, both of them were winning championships, you know, doing very, very well. But have they almost been forgotten about a little bit because they're not in open wheel racing?
Absolutely, and I also think DTM doesn't have the same exposure. Yes, it's broadcast in the UK, but because it's the German touring cars, you know, it's predominantly German. We've had this discussion a few weeks ago about how they take it to other parts of the world, but it is predominantly German, and it's people are more interested in Germany about it, so it doesn't get the same exposure here. And you really need to be in a kind of world championship to be getting the praise you deserve, and I totally agree with you. There have been forgotten about Gary Paffett, because he was, I think, a test driver for McLaren's Formula 1 team, and it never came to much. And it's the same with Paul de Resta, Pascal Wehrlein as well. A lot of people don't actually know that he was the DTM world champion in 2015, so yeah, it is a bit of a kind of forgotten series, if you like, especially in these parts. But over in Germany, I'd imagine they're very, very enthusiastic about it.
And there was big news with regards to new title sponsorship for Formula E, but
maybe we were expecting something else given the build-up ahead of that announcement.
Yeah, I got out of my bed early, saw Formula E was live on Facebook, clicked on it and was waiting for this big announcement. Big for the sport, let's not take anything away, to have this big sponsor, I suppose, and obviously they're specialists in these kind of robotic stuff, and you've obviously got Roborant's that kind of series with driverless cars.
That'll be interesting.
It certainly will. So, I mean, if you're going to pick a company to be a title sponsor, then I suppose AB, who've got that knowledge in there, you know, it's a good partnership for Formula E.
And just looking ahead to the race in Morocco this weekend, Sam Bird leads the Drivers' Championship on 35 points after winning the first round and finishing fifth in the second event, and he must fancy his chances going into this race.
Absolutely, I'm a big fan of Sam Bird. You know, he did very well in GP2 in that season. He's had involvement in Mercedes F1 team, a bit underrated in my opinion actually, and he's done very well in Formula E. He's never had the most competitive car like the Renault or the Audi, and I think he's had about 6 wins now in Formula E, which is either the third or the fourth most, and considering he's not always been in a competitive car, that's a fantastic job from Sam Bird. So I'm really looking forward to seeing how he gets on. And I think if he does have a good run, we get more British interest, and with Paul Durest as well, then Formula E could have a big future back in this country. It's also going to be interesting to see how Lucas de Grassi, Sebastian Buemi get on, because you know they're already 34 and 35 points behind Sam Bird, and that's not easy to catch up, and those two have been the front runners in Formula E for so long now. They've had that incredible rivalry, so it'll be interesting to see how the big names actually get back in Marrakesh this weekend. So it's going to be a fascinating race,
and the wheel-to-wheel action has been pretty good as well. You know, we even had a red flag for the first time ever coming out in Formula E too. You know, it's pretty entertaining stuff if you give it the chance.
Absolutely, and that's the big question: are people willing, prepared to give up? You know, especially in Saturday afternoon, some of the races are broadcast, and that's not the ideal time, really, is it, to broadcast race? I get that they're trying to do these events over one day, make it different, and that's absolutely right, that they do try something different. But yeah, I hope people do give Formula E the chance, and I said if Sam Bird can have a good run at the championship, if Paul Durest maybe gets a seat next season in Formula E, then it's just going to gain more interest. And we've already talked on the show a few weeks ago about all the big name manufacturers that are now coming into Formula E, and I think that will draw attention as well to the sport.
And that's absolutely it. You know, Formula E is here to stay, and I think perhaps by having British drivers like Sam Bird, Paul Durest potentially coming in, that's only going to help just add to the publicity as well over here.
Absolutely, you're spot on. And what you said about the racing as well, the racing has been phenomenal, it really has. You're guaranteed wheel-to-wheel action. And some of the races have been, or a lot of the races have been more exciting than Formula 1 in recent times. You know, a lot of drivers always tend to get disqualified though for this kind of running out of energy. And that's one thing they need to sort out, because you watch a race and it happens quite regularly. So there's a few teething issues that still need to be sorted with the series. But as you said, it's here to stay. Electric cars are the future. You know, a lot of people have said that they're going to be banning other cars and it'll just be electric cars by 2040, so certainly here to stay.
Now it's time for one of my favourite parts of Pole Position, because this is where we put Adam on the spot, because we're going to give him just 60 seconds to tell us as many stories as he can in the world of motorsport. So Adam, you've got a perfect record so far, so let's see if you can do it again. I'm going to put 60 seconds on the clock and your time starts now.
Right, starting with Formula One, and Kimi Raikkonen's race engineer Dave Greenwood has announced his departure from Ferrari ahead of the new season. After 3 years at Maranello, Greenwood is set to take up a role within Manor's World Endurance Championship project. Mercedes F1 boss Toto Wolff has said that Pascal Wehrlein will remain part of the Mercedes family, despite him set to miss out in an F1 seat for the 2018 season. The German raced with Sauber last year, but is rumoured to be considering a return to DTM, where he became the youngest winner back in 2015. Plans for a Danish Grand Prix in the capital Copenhagen have moved a step closer following the latest meeting between organisers and Liberty Media's Chase Carey. Cosworth has admitted that it's unlikely to return to F1 as an independent engine supplier unless they get investment from a manufacturer sponsor. And finally, into Formula E, and minimum pit stop times will be no more, starting with immediate effect at this weekend's race in Marrakesh. The decision by the FIA has had a mixed response, with safety concerns being raised by drivers.
Superb, Adam. The unbeaten streak continues. Very well done. And unfortunately, that's all we've got time for. But we'll be back from 8 o'clock next Thursday night to do it all again. My thanks to Adam for joining me in the studio. And thanks to you for tuning in as well. And stick around for Ian Martin coming up next.
Love music. Live sport. Pole Position with Andy Alston on Rock Sport Radio.